the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program. Friends and enemies, welcome to a very special noon episode of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast on the CBP Media Network. You know it's good because Len and I don't do noon episodes unless we have a guest in different time zones. So today, as we mentioned on Monday, we're talking to Ron Butler, Butler Mortgage. We got a lot to discuss, Len. Housing market is very volatile, as we know. Rates
are
stable. Yeah, sure. Rates very top of mind for many Canadians. I know actually my wife and I today are talking to the bank about what our trigger rate is and whether or not we can raise our payment and all these sorts of different things that many Canadians should be thinking about. And I've heard Ron talk about on a few different mediums. So looking forward to discussing that with him. He's running it just a hair late. So we'll do the ad reads and Len's going to do an interpretive dance to fill the time if we need it. Our first sponsor, Len, is ShakePay, best place for Canadians to buy Bitcoin. Many things going on at ShakePay, Len. I just got my ShakePay earned position. I'm a 7% guy, which I'm happy about. So if you keep a CAD balance, get interest paid out in Bitcoin weekly, which is great. I think it's the lowest balance you carry that week in CAD that you get paid on. So make sure you keep that balance topped up. Also, there is, of course, the Shaking Sats promotion, where if you use our promo code to sign up, CBP, Charlie Beta Peter, you can get a few Satoshis right to your wallet every day. Just wake and shake. Not a bad idea. Up to 1,000 after a year of consecutive shaking. They also have, what do they got? Then they got Shake Paid, where if you spend off your CAD balance, they might comp you in Satoshis, which is dope. They got Shaking Sats, Sats Back, where if you spend off your CAD balance, you get 2% back in Satoshis on the first 5,000, 1% after that. And I'm sure they got many more things in the pipeline. We talk to Carlo pretty often. We like the service. We use the service. We hope you do.
Shake Squad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we don't have to mention every single thing. We don't have a read. If I mention every single thing every time, by the time, next year rolls around, we'll be doing the read for 5 minutes. So we're not going to get into
that.
They
keep adding more stuff to this.
I know. That's what I'm saying. I'm not doing that. We got to put that in the next contract. Maximum 1 minute, 30 seconds. Like, I can't read off every single thing and make a comment. First of all, I don't have that much material. Run it on 3x speed. Who's the other sponsor?
Well, Ledin is the other sponsor. It's a great way to earn some Satoshis if you park your Bitcoin. You could also earn a yield on your USDC if you park your USDC on their platform. So open up an account with our code below and fund your Ledin account with 150,000 sats or 75 USDC and keep it on their platform for at least 15 consecutive days. And Ledin will give you 10 USDC added to your account, no questions asked. Also, if you have some bills you want to pay, don't want to sell your Bitcoin, it's sitting right now 19.2, so not the greatest number, but it's still decent enough. You don't want to sell it. Who does? Borrow against it. Ledin is there to help you out. You could then use your Bitcoin as collateral, 50% loan to value. You're good to go. They give you the money, and you could go ahead and pay your bills. But if you are the eternal optimist and 19.2, you think, man, it's pretty low. It's going to go up in the next little while. Well, double up your Bitcoin stack with the B2X option. And if you do it right, time the market correctly, when you come in low and come out high, don't do like Biden with the price of oil. Do it like everybody else when it comes to investing. Well, then you'll have some more Bitcoin in your stack simply by timing the market and using B2X option. And there's also the Bitcoin-backed mortgages industry first. And it's also very applicable for today's show because we'll be talking about real estate. This is an industry first when they rolled it out. Lots of hubbub about it when it came out. But not available in every jurisdiction. So if you do want to take advantage of a Bitcoin-backed mortgage, check Ledin's website to see where it's being offered. But since you're there, check to see what the rates are for the savings and borrowing because they change on a month-to-month basis.
We got lots to talk about today when it comes to mortgages. So I don't know, Len, like what questions do you have for Ron? And we talk about housing in Canada basically every week now. What's top of mind for you? I know I got a few. What do you got?
Well, I'm curious because just today we had the release of the Canadian CPI, and that I suspect is going to be a driving factor what the Bank of Canada is going to be doing moving forward. And of course, what the Bank of Canada does drives what's going to be happening with the housing market here. So I'm curious to know what Ron's thoughts are based on the CPI, if he had enough time to digest it and what he thinks is going to be moving forward with that. How about you, Joey?
That's a big one. I want to know some stuff from... or based on his sort of on the ground knowledge. Ron runs one of the largest private brokerages, mortgage brokerages in the country. And you know, he's got a lot of experience and presumably talks to a lot of people about where they are in their mortgage slash home ownership journey. So, you know, I think there's a number of Canadians who, for the first time, are really giving a lot of thought to what their mortgage looks like month to month, quarter to quarter, year to year. Like I mentioned in the intro, you know, my wife and I now talking about adding to our monthly payment to avoid this, you know, not paying any principal down scenario where if you hit your trigger rate, you know, that's the situation you'll
are
be
you
in.
So you're in a variable then?
I'm variable. Yeah. Oh yeah. I have a very small mortgage, so I'm fortunate in that regard. But you know, it's something I didn't want to have to consider, but certainly after today's print, 75 bips, you know, looking fairly likely right next week. I think that's probably a safe bet, you know, if not higher. And, at some point, you know, that number is going to be really detrimental to a lot of homeowners. There's a lot of people with much bigger mortgages than me who bought, you know, in the last 18 months at a generational top, it looks like, in housing. It's a bad situation, man. I'm lucky. My wife and I, you know, paid barely anything for this house 5-6 years ago, I guess 7 years ago now. I can hardly believe how long it's been. So, that's my situation. I also want to ask about his thoughts on foreign buyers propping up the real estate market here.
Hasn't that been sort of stopped because there was rules put in place to prevent that, or at least put?
Let's see what he says. I fucking doubt it, honestly, that it stopped. I doubt it for a number of reasons. One, because foreign students have increased their piece of the pie in Canada, and those kids aren't living on the street. They're living in houses that I suspect are being purchased by their parents or, you know, whatever other shadow, shady corporation or body is able to do that for them, right? So I look at that as one metric. And the other one I look at is, you know, just the price of homes on the West Coast. We did talk about how some of that stuff is kind of plateauing, but I don't know. I again, you and me discuss fairly often the real estate market and how it looks over here in Ontario. There has been a drop off a little bit, but I think it's starting to slow down. I think that drop is starting to slow down a little bit. I don't know. What do you think?
No, I don't think, because it's only just been recent since when was the top that we've seen? Was it earlier this year or late last year?
Last year, probably November, December, maybe.
Yeah. So and given the fact they have been raising rates starting March, it takes some time for people to absorb that. Also, when you get pre-approved for a mortgage, that also it's for 90 days or something like that. So you got to wait for that to also get wiped off the books. Because if you're getting pre-approved, say today, and they raise rates tomorrow, well, you got pre-approved from today's rates.
Well, let's see what the expert has to say. Ron is joining us now.
Yes.
Ron's a busy guy. His assistant came in and told us he was on a call. Now, we asked Jess to sit in, Ron. She refused. So I don't know if that's going to go on her performance review or whatever, but
we were going to send her swag. We had shirts, hats, everything.
Ron. I don't know, Ron, what kind of operation you're running over there, Ron. What's going on? How are you?
I'm good. Sorry, guys. The regulator Zoom call that was supposed to have a hard stop and did not have a hard stop. So yeah.
It's all good, brother.
Always hard to tell the regulator you're going to get up and leave. You know, like, yeah, you're running too long, guys. I mean, it's hard to do. Yeah. Anyway, glad to be here. Thanks for getting in touch with me and fire away. What would you like to know?
Well, let's talk first about who you are and what you do, because I know who you are and what you do. I've listened to you a couple of times now in a couple of different mediums, but a lot of our listeners is a Bitcoin crowd, Ron, but they're going to want to know who you are and how you made it to the CBP here.
Sure. So I'm a mortgage broker for 28 years. We've licensed in 3 provinces, British Columbia, Alberta, and here in Ontario. Our headquarters is in Ontario. And do a lot of mortgages for a long time. It's almost all residential, a little bit of commercial. But that's the story. We just have done thousands and thousands and thousands of residential mortgages for a very long time.
I like
Ron,
it.
Did you happen to see the CPI print that was released earlier today?
Yes,
I'm not sure if you're... Yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are that it has very, very, very little impact on what the Bank of Canada is going to do. I'll be honest with you, the more I listen to Pivot talk, the more tired I am of it. Okay. The funny part is that, you know, we all suffer from cognitive biases, right? So, you know, we're so used to something being the way it is for so long, low mortgage rates, rising house prices. I'm just doing a piece on Twitter now that it's literally 32 years since there's been any real major correction in real estate in Canada. And we just can't even keep it in our minds. It's so foreign to the majority. If you're somebody who was 28 and bought a house in 1990, which was the 1990 through 1996, extremely, that was a major fall off of nearly of an average of about 27% from 1989. And therefore, but if you bought a house then, you're age 28, you are 60 now, and you have never really seen any meaningful correction in real estate in Canada, like nothing, like a sweet FA. Okay. So, the idea, everybody just talks pivot all the time because, hey, these rates can't last forever. It's impossible. Okay. No, it's fucking not. It's not impossible. Okay. Like it can run for a long run. I mean, it can be a couple of years of rates that, might touch six, might go into the sixes. When they come back down, they may only come back down into the fours. But, we got everybody saying, well, look at that CPI print. They're going to change everything. Everything's going to change right away. No, hell no, not going to change right away. Okay. It's just I get it that in finance, we like to think about every microscopic print of everything and how it's going to, how something's on the horizon or something is about to change because of what we're looking at. But rates are just going to keep going up. They're not going to go to, if we think about what we call always referred to as the overnight rate in Canada, which is the rate the Bank of Canada sets. We're not going to, there's going to be some kind of a pause at 4.25 or 4.50 and see what happens. But if people are thinking it's going to go back to 2 this year or even 2.5 this year, they're off their rockers. I mean, it's just ridiculous. All right. So this thing's going to be around for a while. And that's the real story. Like trying to dig a pivot out of every, like literally out of a 10 basis point move in CPI is just pointless. Like it doesn't make sense.
I don't think it makes a lot of sense either. I want to ask you why you think, given that most international, and I think Canadian markets as well, are pricing in a rate decrease Q1 23 right now. What makes you say that the bank is just absolutely no fucking way?
Let's define what we mean by a rate decrease. Are we talking about a central bank decrease?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like whoever is saying there's going to be a central bank rate reduction in the United States or Canada or damn near anywhere else in Q1 2023 is they're on the mushrooms. Okay. Like they really, it's psychedelic. That's what it is. It's complete hallucination. It doesn't make any sense. All right. Will there be a pause in Q1 2023? Sure. That's quite possible. I don't necessarily discount that. But the idea that there's going to be a pivot and rates will fall in Q1 2023, it's strictly people who are on the hopium pipe. That's it.
Go on, Joy.
I'm curious. Okay, there's a couple of things I want to pull on from the comments you made when you came on here. One is this thing about a meaningful correction. Now, I was just saying before you got on, I bought my house when I was 28, about 7 years ago. And certainly the thing has been,
thing is in 1990, I think you might've been sperm.
Okay? I was very young. So what's the meaningful correction you're looking for in the market? Cause I think, I don't know the correction we're in now is pretty significant.
In 1990, we saw corrections from the 1989 high, of depending on the neighborhood of somewhere between 25 and 50%. Now the worst possible, the average comes out at probably about 28. It was a weird, it's a different dynamic back then. The most afflicted marketplace were condominium apartments. And the average for the whole province, they went down 37% as an average. Now you realize there's some at 55 now, if you're hitting that kind of an average, right? So in single family, it was down 26%. And again, for something to be an average in real estate, which is all local and every place is different, different effect on different neighborhoods and regions, then some places were down 45%. Some neighborhoods went down 45% from the peak. That's a meaningful correction. And it's also very meaningful if it stays flat for 5 years. Duration, just like sex and real estate are the same. Duration is very important. Okay. Of how long is it going to last? Okay. And when something's just 8 months, like if we really are serious and think rationally, during the 2008 financial crisis, where the mortgage crisis in the United States, where their market, just residential market, just crashed, and there was literally a couple of million foreclosures and tremendous deleveraging, like massive deleveraging in that country. It was huge. It was over here in 10 months. Like nothing, it was like nothing happened after 10 months in 2008. And matter of fact, 2009 was a pretty decent real estate year for sales and prices, and really a complete recovery by the end of 2009. And 2010 was a pretty damn robust real estate year, okay? Whereas it was just a desert in the United States for almost 4 years, 5 years. So they went through a massive deleveraging. We never did. So the last massive deleveraging we went through is 1990.
Back then, I was noting that even office rentals were, they dropped significantly. So commercial real estate took a real kick to the nuts in Toronto in the early 90s. Yeah. And I saw there was an article posted very recently in the Financial Post talking about pre-construction condo flippers that are just, they're left to hold a bag because unfortunately they're not able to flip because the market is just so soft. Is this going to have a real impact? Is it going to trickle into other aspects of real estate? And also, will construction be impacted moving forward too? Because this is something that's really concerning to me. Real estate is so tied to the GDP of Canada. And if real estate takes a real downturn, the GDP for Canada is also going to be taking a big downturn as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good question. People who are buying pre-construction condos with the intention of never closing, that is to say they're going to flip the condo by assignment for profit. They are, into the, same 100% rug pull category as NFTs. Okay. Like literally every single person is going to feel the rug pull. Like it's going to be universal. So they're not going to be able to flip. Now there's a bunch of timing issues there because we've got to realize again, real estate is a timing thing. So if you bought a pre-construction condo 1 year ago, you're in a terrible place in theory, because those prices come way down. You could have signed an agreement for a price that's going to be less, maybe even 20% or less than when you finally get there. However, it's 5 or 6 or 7 years before you get there. So who the hell knows? Now you could be fine, or you could have died, or lots of things could have happened. So that's the thing about the people who bought in the last 18 months to 24 months. So let's think about the people who have a real issue. They are people who bought 5.5 years ago, and their condos are coming on stream and they are having a hard time assigning it. Now, in some cases, they're not worried because, again, real estate is local. Not everything is the same. And some of those are great projects, and they've actually gone up in price so much since they were purchased 6 years ago, 5.5 years ago, that even though they've come off some in the last 10 months, they're still worth more. So you might be able to flip those on assignment. And you also might say, well, I made so much money on it, I could, go to a hard money lender if I can't really close, or I'm not really qualified. I go to a hard money lender and I could at least close. And then I could sell later, in a more calm way. But so that's a consideration. But there are some who bought crap projects. They bought crap projects. I mean, not every project is the same. Somebody is a terrific location, sought after location in the downtown core, or a sought after location on the lakefront, or a sought after location in the Vancouver, in a really great location, a great building. And it's just people have been looking forward to a closing. And there's other people who bought something ridiculous in Pickering or something stupid in Port Coquitlam. Okay. Like a condo in Port Coquitlam. Who wants that? Okay. Real estate's local. So yes, in the past, everything was going up so straight up that even that crap thing in Port Coquitlam you could flip it. You could, you know, it was worth more. There was possibility for profit. That may not be true today.
What about people who are in a single family situation? They bought a pre-build. I'm from the Hamilton area. I know there's a couple of pre-builds in Waterdown and surrounding, you know, municipalities there that are delayed now by about a year. So you would have had to commit a year ago.
Yep.
And you won't be able to move in for until, you know, maybe May or June next year. What kind of situation are those people in? You know, in your experience, is that a common thing? It's probably becoming more common now. What would you tell those people?
Well, new construction for single family or for freehold townhouses is always an 18-month process. So if we're going to string out to an extra to maybe 28 months or 30 months, that's not really shocking, right? That's not, you know, that you can live with that. But there's now a series of problems. If you were selling a place in expectation of buying this place, your own place is going to sell for less. And there's a possibility that that place in Waterdown, although there's some good projects in Waterdown, but there's a possibility that that place is not even going to be worth, it's a possibility. It's not going to be worth what you paid for it. But wait, there's more. So it's like ShamWow. The reality is that you may have bought that place as an investment. It might be a rental townhouse. And you were going to use you got a line of credit on your house, which had gone way up since you bought it in 2014. It had gone way up. So you put a big line of credit on your house, a HELOC. And you're saying, well, I'm going to take I took a bunch of down payment out of that HELOC. Now I'm going to put my 20% down payment or my 15% down payment. And then, you know, when it comes to but now all of a sudden it's a holy shit moment. The minimum payment on my HELOC is gone up 110%, heading for 150. Like, holy shit. I mean, that is so I got a bad economic situation over there on my down payment. I got a plate. I think my own place is not worth as much. And I think that I'm going to have to, you know, you talk about pre-approvals. You know, there's no, unless you bought a cap rate program, and some people might have, because some developers hook up with banks and sell cap rate programs, which gives you like 2 years. But if you exceed the 2 years, you might have a problem again. The cap rate program may have died at 24 months. So you might be coming into a high rate environment on the mortgage you're going to need for that rental. And already your line of credit payments have gone up 150%. Like that leverage. If you're buying investment properties taking that mythical Waterdown condo unit, there's a townhouse units, that could be a real problem. It's possible.
Then with respect to home equity line of credit, I want to touch on this a little bit more because some of the stats I'm reading, this applies more in the States. I hear that people are going into debt to fund their lifestyle. They're not willing to tighten their belts given that the price of everything is going up. Now, over here in Canada, I'm wondering if you know if people are using home equity line of credits in order to fund their existing lifestyle and further getting into debt using this supposed cheap credit in order to make ends meet.
You know, our business to fund thousands of mortgages a year, right? So I would tell you that the thing you just described is people using HELOCs, lines of credit, home equity lines of credit to fund vacations and, you know, look after payments on credit cards. That's not a thing here, really. It's just not. I even question whether it's a big thing in the United States. I think that people may have used HELOCs to make crappy investments, and that's very harmful. Okay. There was a mortgage brokerage in Ontario, a relatively big one, which just specializes in alternative, you know, sort of difficult lending scenarios, they don't really do any bank mortgages. They don't do any prime mortgage, A mortgages, but they were encouraging people to do refinance and lending to buy Dogecoin and NFTs. Okay. And they just happened to be, you know, NFT. So, and we will recommend to you the best possible NFT products, which we, you know, which my cousin may be the dealer on that. And, you know, like, I'm not shitting you. Like, it is the craziest thing in the world, but people were being encouraged. There was a group of just very unsavory son of a bitch mortgage brokers who were encouraging people to use the growth, the massive growth in equity in their homes right up to, you know, the end of 2021 to get investments, to acquire investments. Okay. And that was good. That's going to be hellacious. Thank God there's only, it was only very small, but we don't actually see much of that. We don't see much of people. We do refinances. We do more, you know, HELOCs. We don't see much of what you're talking about in Canada. We really don't.
What, Ron, what about this thing that's become part of like the day-to-day lexicon for a lot of Canadians, the trigger rate? Okay. I didn't know anything about the trigger rate 2 months ago. Now I think about the trigger rate all the time. I see my buddy Tiff on the mic there. He's sweating. And I look at this guy and I think, I've never seen a man perspire this way in front of a television setup.
You are triggered. You're triggered by the trigger rate. Okay. Like, they give a trigger warning on the podcast. Holy shit. You might get triggered by hearing about the trigger
rate. It's an applicable name. It's an applicable name.
You can't handle it. Don't watch this next segment. Okay.
So what is this thing? Why should I give a shit about it? And how many people who don't know about this thing are going to start really caring about it in the next month or 2 months?
Well, they care about it right now because, you know, every lender has a portal. Like every lender, you can go and look at your mortgage live, real time, every day. You can sign into CIBC or RBC or TD. You can look at your mortgage. It's got a ton of information there. And if you've got a variable rate, one of the things you've been seeing, if you're not at the bank, there's two of the big six banks, your payment increases every time prime goes up. So they have no trigger rate. It's really simple. Your prime went up, you pay more. That's it. And don't get me wrong, a lot of those people are not particularly happy at all. Okay. But they're in the category of no surprises. Like they see the effect of prime rate increase every single day. Okay. Every single 6 weeks when TIFF raises the rate, they see it. It comes in as a change in their payment almost immediately. So that's two of the four remaining big six banks. They do have trigger rates and trigger points. There's two different things. There's a trigger rate, the trigger point. And I would tell you that those people look at their mortgage, they go online, they click on the mortgage box, they look at and the thing that jumps out at them is something that's called remaining amortization. So if we think about a mortgage, when you get a mortgage, you either have a 20-year, 25-year amortization when you first get a mortgage, you have a 30-year amortization. And if you have a low down payment, you always have 25-year amortization to start with. A lot of people start with a 30-year if they have a conventional mortgage. And when they click on the page and they have a variable rate, and the variable rate was called static payment, which is four out of the six big banks, static payment, your payment doesn't change until some trigger point occurs or a trigger rate happens, trigger point. And these people who haven't hit this trigger yet, when they click on their mortgage, they thought they were going to have 28-year amortization, but now they have 92-year amortization. Okay. So the 92-year amortization is that, let's think about a mortgage payment. So when you start off with a variable rate, if you started a variable rate last year, your interest rate, the actual interest on your mortgage was probably about 1.3 to 1.4. It had been as low as 1.25, might have been as high as 1.5, but that was what it was. All of those rates are now in the fours. Every single one of them is now in the fours. Now, let's think about how a mortgage works. You started with a $2,000 a month payment. And when you first looked at it, it would show you on an amortization schedule that about $400, $450 is going towards interest cost, and the remaining $1,550 was going towards paying down your principal, which is great. Your mortgage is going down really fast. So when you looked at it, say a month ago, the amount of interest in that $2,000 a month payment was now $1,740, and you're only paying down $260. Well, after the next increase at the end of the month, this month, you're going to be backwards. Like the interest is now going to go over $2,000. But that's why you see these 92-month 92-year amortization information, because you're not paying anything down on the mortgage. So let's talk about that. What happens when the most important thing to understand about triggers is something that we refer to in the business as negative amortization. That's when instead of your mortgage, you're paying your principal down, you aren't paying your principal down. the mortgage grows. So the mortgage grows, like the interest is so much, the payment's not enough to cover it, but the mortgage grows every month. Now, of their four big banks, three of them say, you need to find a way to make sure that doesn't happen. And that's the trigger point. So of those three, they would say, well, they have various different approaches to it, but the biggest one is RBC would say, you just got to make sure that it doesn't grow. So you have to adjust your payment to the point, and we'll tell you how much it needs to be. You have to adjust your payment to the point where you're paying down at least $2 of your mortgage each month.
How many years of amortization is that?
200. Okay. So maybe three. But let's face it. When you got the mortgage, in all likelihood, the person who you were talking to about the mortgage told you your payment wouldn't change. That's reality, right? I mean, when you're sitting in front of someone, somebody, you know, because guess what? For the last 16 years or more, it hasn't changed. Nobody had hit a trigger point in like almost two decades. So why would the person you're talking to in the call center or in person with one of the RBC mortgage reps, why would they say, oh, by the way, this could all go to rat shit and you will end up with 300-year amortization? That's a possibility. Literally nobody would say that, because it's not in their lived experience, okay? So nobody talked about it, and let's face facts. If your general expectation is that your mortgage would not go up and your mortgage payment would not go up, you don't want it to go up. Like, you don't want it to go up. You know, when we talk to the people who are with the banks that the payments go up, with the lenders that the payments go up, they are not friggin' happy. They are unhappy. They're unhappy. They're worried. They're concerned. They're mad that they didn't take a fixed. I mean, so when RBC says you just have to make sure that you're not, your mortgage doesn't grow, people are still mad about that. You know, even if it only costs like $60 a month to, you know, 2000, it turns into 2060, they're still pissed off about the 60. Meantime, the guy at one of the other banks has gone to $3,000, you know, 3,100 he's paying. Okay. Because he's increased all along the way. So, but you know, by December, everybody with those contracts, with the exception of one bank, TD's is a different approach. TD says that the mortgage can grow. TD says the mortgage can grow. We will let you know it's growing so you can take appropriate action, because you need to understand that it's not a great idea that your mortgage grows. We will tell you about it. We will illustrate what it would take for you to make sure it doesn't grow. But they don't actually force an increase. Like, TD would allow your mortgage to grow under the variable contract, leave your payment the same, allow it to grow until the growth exceeded, in the case of conventional mortgages, until the growth exceeded 80% of your starting loan to value. So in other words, right, if you put 30% down, you might never get there till the mortgage renews. You would just see the mortgage grow and grow and grow and grow. Okay. So, and people say, oh, well, that's not good. And because that's like, again, we got like the 300-year amortization again. And yet those people, the TD customer is not pissed off. They're pissed off at TIF Macklin that the prime has gone so high, but they're not pissed off that their payment hasn't changed. They're not, in some ways, they're less worried than others. So that's just a normal human reaction. A normal human reaction is, I don't want my payment to go up if I thought it wouldn't. I don't want it to go up. That's human.
But what do you tell people? Wait a minute. What do you tell people? Should they be?
You want to avoid 200-year amortization. You really do. Like, it's not a good idea. You should. And here's the thing. Everyone was stress tested at a much higher rate, right? Much higher rate. So You've got, you know, we were stress testing these customers at 5.25 when their actual rate was 1.45. We were stress testing them at a much, much higher rate. Okay. Camera went off. I don't know what that was.
Don't worry about it.
I'll turn mine off too.
Right, don't worry about it.
So you've been talking about amortization rates. Now, what, do we lose them all together?
We might have. I don't know. What happened? Man. Hold on. It says they'll need to connect their mic and cam before we add them to the stream. Ron, come back, Ron. What happened?
I had a couple of duties I wanted to pose on him.
What happened? The stuff I'll email Jess right now, but that stuff about the trigger rate is so important, man, for people who are in variable rate situations. I am in a variable rate situation. I know a lot of my friends are. And like I said, we're lucky that that so far it's been fine. But, you know, you got to be careful there. Hold on. Let me see, Jess. We lost Ron.
I'm lucky in that I've locked in some time ago in a five-year rate, so I'm not subjected to that. But we locked in, I think, 3 years ago. So we lost out on quite a bit of savings if we went variable because rates went down considerably and was low for such a long period of time.
We got them back. There's Jess. I just sent you an email, Jess. Thanks for your help.
Jess is my producer.
That's awesome.
Ron, I got a question for you because you talked about amortization quite a bit. And in the past, we used to have at one time 40-year amortization mortgages.
Well, it's a long time ago, long time.
Do you think there's any will to bring something like that back, increase to the 25 or 30-year to something higher?
There is will amongst every real estate agent and mortgage broker in Canada. There is definitely will, okay? It's a stupid idea, but it may happen. The government is discussing this right now. They're talking about using extended amortizations, like you could go back to 30-year or you could even go back to 35-year if you're up for renewal and you're faced with a massive increase in payment. I mean, those discussions are ongoing, so we might see that. But no, there's no, it's not contemplated right now. Like, let's face it, it's stimulus. If you go to 35 and 40-year amortization, that's stimulus. And let's face it, the Bank of Canada right now is not interested in stimulus, and the regulator OSFI is not interested in stimulus. Like, they're already talking to banks about being less aggressive in their underwriting process. So, I mean, I think we'll see some sort of a change to help people who are renewing, and all of a sudden, you know, they had a rate that was 2.69 or 2.89 and a 5-year fixed, and now they're coming into 5.69, and it's just a holy shit moment. And the the regulators and the Department of Finance are considering, are there some ways just to help those people on renewal? Because let's face it, renewal of a mortgage is not stimulus. It's not in any way, shape, or form demand stimulus. It's just people have got a problem. Okay. So that's under consideration, but I don't think we're going to see 35-year or 40-year amortization anytime soon.
There's also another policy that they could pump in, or they already did, and this applies to first-time home buyers. I know this doesn't apply to existing home buyers, but this is the program in which the government took a stake, I think, between 5 and 10% of the ownership of the home. Am I right on this?
Literally the stupidest program that ever existed in the history of mankind. Okay,
I got a question to do with this.
But let me explain it to you why it's so stupid. Okay, so the government says, okay, we're going to throw in 5%. And, what you're going to pay is, by the way, they're a little panicked right now on some people where they threw in 5% and now the house is worth 20% less. Because the whole theory of the program was, we're going to share in the growth of when you sell it, we're going to share in the growth. Or if you refinance it, we're going to share in the growth of what you of how much the house went up in value. We're not going to charge interest. We're in equity position. We work on the raise. We're gonna take a profit on the raise. So the craziest part about that is when you buy a house, if you own a house, you discover something. Son of a bitch takes maintenance. you need to fix shit that breaks and spend money on it. You need to paint it sometimes. When you buy a brand new house, it is like terrible. Like, you got a million things to do. You don't even have landscaping. You're spending money endlessly. Okay. Plus you're paying the property tax. I don't think the government of Canada is paying their 5% share of the property tax. I don't think so. I mean, you literally are spending all the money and the government of Canada is sharing in the profits. Like, literally stupidest thing on earth. Okay. Like, you couldn't imagine a dumber program. That's it. Every program the government has launched on this file, like, there's a program about, they're going to set up, there's going to be a home ownership savings program next year. Right? We heard about that. That's coming, right?
Homeownership savings. With it. What is this?
There's a homeownership savings program coming. It's going to be, you can have your RRSP. And if you've never bought a home, you can start putting money away. It's not tax deductible, but it's interest free. Okay. So you're going to put money in. It's like a TFSA for houses. Okay. Like, actually, no, I think there might be some tax deduction element. It isn't effective till next year, so I haven't been paying that much attention to it. But let's explore the incredible stupidity of that. Okay, you're actually going to set up a whole bureaucracy to run a whole different program. You're going to have every bank set up a bureaucracy, spend their own money to set up a way to manage this program and report it, because you have to report every program to CRA. You have to T4 it. You have to do something with it, right? You got to have it. You got to have make sure that this money is segregated, so you just have to buy a house with it. Okay, so could we just change the RSP? You know, could we just do that? You know, and say, okay, we leave the RSP program and we're going to designate that as years go by, you can have this percentage of your RSP contribution. You can take it out as a down payment. You wouldn't have to set up a whole new program. You just have to make a little bit of amendments. Banks wouldn't have to spend a fortune setting up a new system. Like, if everything the government does in this file is stupid AF. Like, you cannot even, like, seriously, we have so many programs now. I mean, we got an RSP. We got our ESP for a children's education. We got a friggin' TFSA for, I don't know, help people save. I mean, then it turned out it was just an account that people used to put money into the stock market. Okay. So then, or buy NFTs. I didn't know how well that worked out. But anyway, the whole thing is that we set up all these programs because governments want to do theater. Governments want to be seen to be doing something. And then nothing happens, just more bad results, okay? And massive bureaucracy. I mean, $52 million for an app? Like, holy shit, that's like crazy stuff. Anyway, go ahead, guys. What's your next question?
Well, this first-time home buyers incentive program, and this is from a layman like me, so I don't have skin in the game as much as you do. The way I look at it, it's just artificially inflating the price because now there's an extra 5 or 10% equity potentially floating around for new home buyers that could come in. Is that essentially what happened here? Am I wrong?
It's not. You still had to come up with a down payment. Literally, the program just is literally stupid. I mean, it's just about you having potentially a smaller first mortgage, because you know if the government says, well, we're going to give you $50,000 towards this purchase price. Your mortgage is smaller. The government had the same requirements for down payment. Like you didn't supply a down payment for you. It just, the idea was to reduce your monthly payment because your mortgage would be $50,000. I'm just using arbitrary 50,000, but your mortgage would be smaller. Therefore your payment would be smaller. Okay. But you have to give it back when you sell the house, right? And the government didn't share in the taxes. The government didn't share in the maintenance. The government didn't plant any trees. The government didn't cut the grass. I mean, like, but they share in the rise and the lift. Okay. Now, I don't know how they're going to work out sharing on the decrease. That's going to be totally weird. But it's just a dumb program. It wasn't really even stimulative, to be honest with you. This thing for the, if it wasn't so stupid, this new homeowner savings program could be considered stimulative, but you know, it's just the wrong timing for it. So I don't know whether, you know, it's going to really do anything except cost Canadian taxpayers money for bureaucracy.
Ron, in your view, if you have one, what is the role of foreign investment in the real estate bubble, we'll call it, that we're seeing in Canada? I've heard a million things from a million people with less involvement in the real estate sector than you. I'm curious if you have a view. I got to know, is this as bad a situation as the worst naysayers would have me believe? Is it something else? What's up with that?
Well, the first thing to understand about it is it's real. Anybody who says, oh no, it's nothing, it's like not even 0.5%. They are full of shit. Okay. Like there is been at least $200 billion come from China into the Canadian real estate market. I think with the trouble in Iran today, there's probably $1 billion a month being sifted into Canada from Iran, all stealing from the people of Iran. It's all clerics and generals sifting money through Cyprus and Qatar, two relatives here in Canada who buy rent mansions. They like to put money in real estate. You ever thought about why do they want to put the money in real estate? Did that ever cross anybody's mind? Why real estate, right? Why would they buy real estate with the money? Because they always felt that, and this is true, they felt that if we left it in banks, our government, one day if our government decides to come looking for it, they could just approach the Canadian government and say, hey, this guy's got $3 billion in a bank. We think he stole it from China, we think he stole it from Iran, and we want our money back, okay? Whereas if you buy a house through your child, because that's typically what they do, they send money to the accounts of their children here in Canada or their spouses who become permanent residents or become Canadian citizens. So they, if you think about it, we run per capita the biggest foreign student program in the world here. If you look at a per capita basis, we're number one. So a lot of things we're number one in. Okay, like white collar crime, money laundering. Okay. Per capita, we're number one in lots of things. So, you know, if $200 billion has come over from China, it's never going back, and it's coming to the hands of permanent residents, Canadian citizens. The reason they bought property with it is it's a lot harder to confiscate property than it is to freeze money in a bank account. Does that make sense? See how that works? Okay. So the answer is yes, there's a ton of foreign money in Canada, and it has had a pervasive effect on gradual price increases, because the other wacky thing about it is a certain percentage of that real estate is left empty. So there's nobody lives in it. You know, they have a tax in Vancouver for empty homes. So every time you see real estate offered on for sale, it always says owner occupied. But in the pictures, there's no clothing in the house. Like, you look at the pictures online, you look at the closet, there's the closet over there. Da, da, da. The kitchen's got no food in it. The closet has no clothes in it, but it's owner occupied. How the fuck did that happen? Okay. Because it's just designed to avoid the empty homes tax. So let's face it, we're in a country where we've had a massive real estate price run up. And yet, there's homes here and condos. Like, there was one guy did a study of one condominium building that was very well known for rentals. He lived across the street from it. So he put a camera on at night for 3 months, like from as soon as the sun started to go down right through to the morning. And he determined that on that side of the building where his camera is running, fully 55% of the units, the lights never went on for 6 months. Okay. So they are empty. The friggin' condos are empty. All right. This is all real. So in a country which has rapidly rising real estate prices, we're leaving places empty. So that's the pernicious effect of foreign capital. And let's face it, foreign capital, if you have to get your money out of China, if you have to get your money out of Iran, you have a different approach to pricing, right? You just need to get the real estate bought, right? It's not like you're doing a careful calculation about whether you can afford the mortgage, because none of those people work here, right? If you go to, when you, like, we live across, our neighbors across the street are people who, there's a woman who, they're Chinese people, they're Mandarin speaking people, and because we hear them yelling at their gardener in Mandarin, okay? The guy has people cutting the grass, yelling in Mandarin, and there's a woman who doesn't work, she's never driven out of the house in any, you know, cyclical time. Like, she doesn't leave in the morning, come back in the evening. And there's a teenager or who's a student, and there's no man. And yet they every meal is delivered to the house. Like, you know, lunch is delivered, Skip, Uber Eats, you name it. Because my wife works from home, right? So she's literally looking out of her office window at this house all day long. Okay. So that's the reality of Toronto and Vancouver. There are a lot of people who don't work because they are constantly in receipt of money from China or money from Iran or money from other places. And that's the largest grouping, but there are others. Of course, there are other countries. There are countries that don't trust their government, and therefore they want to get money out. And in Canada, they feel the safest thing is put it into real estate, because you can't freeze real estate. Like, it's virtually impossible in this country to do that. You can freeze bank accounts. You can't freeze real estate.
Talk to me a bit more about the students thing, because when you were coming from your conference call, I was saying that one of the reasons I think this is a huge deal is because it's clear to me that even though regulations, quote unquote, are coming down on, you know, vacant homes, you mentioned the speculator's tax or one of its close kin, I still see a ton of foreign students, and they're all living somewhere. Is that really the problem? Like, what can be done about that in your view? Do you have a view on, like, what the fix is?
Look, I mean, first of all, all of our community colleges and universities should hang their heads in goddamn shame that they have really organized about one fifth or one quarter the required housing for students. Okay. And let's separate this out. We have students who are receiving massive support, foreign students who come here. By the way, I'm not opposed to that in general. That's a good profitable industry, is teaching people things. Okay. That's great. I mean, that's a real business, is teaching people things and graduating students. That's a business, and it's a business that Canada should be in. However, the idea that we've got a group of people who are extremely well-financed, a group of these students are very, very well-financed, and got all the money they need, and can rent nice condos in Vancouver and Toronto. And by the way, not too many of them in the University of Manitoba, just saying, but or in Kitchener-Waterloo or London, they can rent. But there's a lot of, now we're looking at, we have a real problem in Toronto, where we're looking at families from East, you know, from South Asia. These kids are over here in school and they are being brutalized by landlords. They've got like a basement where they're paying $800 a month. And by the way, these are families who are just scraping by to get these kids into university. They're not rich people, you know, coming from laundered money. They are just scraping by, and they are living in somebody's basement, and then somebody strung up a sheet on a string, and you got like 200 square feet and a communal stove, okay, and a communal bathroom, and they're paying $800 a month, and they're being ripped off, okay? So yeah, shame on colleges, community colleges and universities in Canada for running it as a factory where they don't care if the student is abused for housing. They just don't care, because they're only supplying housing for about somewhere between 25 and 45% of the students, and everybody else can F themselves, okay? I don't think that's right. And yet, when you talk about it, everybody, basically the university or college tells you to shut up. I mean, you know, because it is a good business. It is a successful Canadian business teaching people. They just don't want to take responsibility for what they're doing.
I want to talk about elderly people that own their homes, and they're on a fixed income right now, and price of everything is going up. And I assume that some of them are tapping into reverse mortgages in order to help make ends meet. Mm-hmm. Tell us exactly what is the process with the reverse mortgage, and is there any perils of using that with the housing market, the prices going down? Is there any issues that could really cause some issues moving forward with the price coming down with homes and using reverse mortgages?
That's a very good question. Reverse mortgage origination was up 263% last year in Canada. The previous year, it started from nothing. Like, don't get too excited. Okay. It's like, you know, like, it's like, you know, you'd say, oh, this NFT value went way, way up. Okay. Yeah. But it was worthless. It is worthless, and it'll go back to being worthless. Okay. So, but it's like that, like reverse mortgages were an incredibly tiny share. Like, they were a microscopic share of the Canadian mortgage market. And then they started to take off in 2019. They grew that year. They grew by 160%. 2020, they grew by 190%. Now it's 263% last year, but they're still small, but it's high growth, obviously high growth. And, but it's not, nobody's in jeopardy. The most anybody will ever lend on these properties by law is 55% of appraised value. And I would tell you that 88% of the time that's cut back by the internal rules of the lender. And I would suggest to you that the average lending on reverse mortgages is around 33%, like it's one third of the value. So the prices have got to fall 66% before anybody's in real trouble. So that's an area that I don't worry about. I worry about other shit, but I don't worry about that one. That one's good. Okay. And in fact, they just started cutting back when the property value started to fall. We got email after email that, oh, we're going to cut back in this area. We're going to go from 43% in this area down to 37% in this area. So there, it's very well managed. It's very well managed, but it is a source for people who want to stay in their homes to stay in their homes. It's a tool. Now, I hope it's not a tool for, you know, that a kid who wants to buy a rental property goes to, you know, his 80-year-old dad and says, well, not a kid anymore, if he's a dad's 80, but it goes to, you know, his 40-year-old says, I want to get on this rental thing. in 2020, and he convinces dad to take a reverse mortgage, and the kid gets all the money. Okay, I mean, that's a bad thing. That is just goddamn disgusting. Okay, or the kid bought Lunacoin. You know, I don't know anything could have happened. All right, but that's bad, and that does happen. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen much. Again, it's a very, very small segment of the market, but it is not a danger to those lenders. Those lenders have been ultra cautious in how they have put up the money to very, very, very low loan to values. So that part's safe.
I'm glad to hear that. Ron, I got one more question for you here before we let you go. You've been mentioning basically every scam in the crypto space for the last 50 or so minutes.
He's well versed.
What's your view on Bitcoin? I mean, we hardly ever ask our non-Bitcoin guests their view on Bitcoin, but you must have one. It seems like you at least have thought about it.
I have one. Bitcoin is, ultimately ridiculous, but it does serve as a tool for money launderers and criminals and people who want to avoid tax. I mean, it is a useful tool for all those folks to be able to transfer money without anybody knowing what's happening. So that's my whole, if we just talk about Bitcoin itself, that's my view of Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is real. I mean, I don't think it's not going to zero. Okay. So the rest of them, well, most of them went to zero. and I would tell you that, an NFT 1000% fraud, like everybody who promoted NFTs. But it was like unknowing fraud. Like I'd say, 5% of the people who were originating NFTs were planning the rug pull. They were the sort of the criminal masterminds behind it. And then a lot of people who just got paid along the way to promote it or whatever. But like, let's face it, we'll look back on NFTs like the 1990, bubble in dot-com bubble. We'll say the same thing. I mean, those were like 800 companies just went out of business in 12 months. Okay. And didn't work out, us delivering dog food to your house every week. Didn't work out. Sorry about that. They just went away. I respect Bitcoin for the fact it's extremely useful for people to try to avoid paying tax and for criminals to exchange funds. Yes.
I like it. Okay. Ron, you're done. You've been a great guest, by the way. Thank you for coming on the show. Now, I'll let you tell people where they can find you, but I want you to talk about your podcast that's apparently in production or on its way out.
Podcast is coming. We encountered a few little technical issues, but podcast is coming. It's called Angry Mortgage. it's designed to suit my personality, okay? And we're going to talk about things that make me mad and it's going to be, it's like I said, I don't want any guests. I don't want any expert guests. Like, I'm not going to have guests like you're having me. It's just going to be like I just might have some like colleagues or folks that work with me, and we'll just sit around a table for half an hour and talk about things that piss me off. And hopefully there'll be some general mortgage information too. Like we can revisit the 200-year amortization for the static payment variable. It's going to be, there would be a lot of swearing. There'd be a few jokes, but there'd be a lot of swearing. All of the staff have insisted that we do not use the see you next Tuesday word. But other than that, it's going to be wide open. Okay. It's going to be absolutely wide open. By the way, was this sort of a PG podcast and I've screwed it up?
About to say, most of the time, guests will at least ask, after they fire off their first F-bomb, they'll say, "Can I swear?" You didn't even ask.
Anything goes, don't worry.
That's great.
If anybody's read my Twitter, they would think, I think this guy's probably going to swear. I mean, I think there's a chance of it.
Your Twitter's worth following. Tell people, Ron, where they can find out more about Butler Mortgage, your Twitter account. It's all yours.
Mortgage is butlermortgage.ca. Really easy. Butler Mortgage is 1T in Butler. It's Ron Mortgage Guy on Twitter. I think all the other social media platforms are stupid, Instagram and Facebook. I mean, like, Facebook is basically your only audience are grandparents. I, as much as I tried to get on OnlyFans, they actually rejected my application. Okay. They just said, you cannot go on OnlyFans, you son of a bitch. We don't want to expose that to the world. Okay. And we're gonna get on to YouTube with the podcast, and you know, we're gonna probably carve out some. I'm actually interested in TikTok. I'm not gonna use any filters or anything, but I'm not gonna have any like big smiley faces or, you know, throw up faces or hearts floating by. I'm not gonna do any of that, but we're gonna chop out some of the, we'll eventually chop out some of the little 120 second stuff that we're doing on the podcast, and we'll throw it up on TikTok and see what people think. But you know, our intention is to tell the truth about mortgages and real estate as we see it, and try to bring a little bit of entertainment to it and swear a lot. That's the future.
Can't wait. Bullish on F-bombs, eh, Len? What do you say? Where can Absolutely. We invest? The F-bomb derivative market. Ron Butler, you've been a great guest. Thank you, sir. We appreciate it. Everyone else,
Sorry I was late. We did hit a hard stop. Thank God. I go on to the next people.
It's all good, man. It's all good. Enjoy the rest of your day, everybody. We'll talk soon.
Take care. Bye-bye now.
Way to go.